in the first chapter of Colossians, we were talking about the preeminence of Christ in us and the ways in which the Spirit of Christ being present in us helps us to live. But I was talking about the problem of religion sometimes being an escape thing, defense mechanism, and that the actual presence of the Spirit of Christ in us will help us, not as an escape mechanism, but as a changing of the patterns of our lives, of changing of our attitudes. That's what we need, you see, change of attitude, change of pattern. I was pointing out last week about the patterns in the brain and saying that we really can only think in terms of those patterns, but it takes the presence and process of Christ in us to help us to really overcome those kinds of things. When you have a selection of data to pick up on from your brain, from the cortex, it is important that the Spirit of Christ in us pick up for us those things we ought to use as accurate data, you see. There's a lot of data there, but not all of it's accurate. See, if we pick up on stuff that isn't accurate, then we make a wrong judgment. So it requires a lot of power from God to really live. And people who try to get along without that may think they're doing very well, and yet in the ultimate they're not doing so well. This may be a very earthy analogy, but it's like the group that goes out to the local bar or go to a party, let's say, and one of the guys gets really smashed. Well, he's the one that figures he's the best driver in the car. Yeah. Always that way. He really thinks he can do it. Well, a lot of people that are screwy as a bolt, they think they're doing great. It's like somebody on pot, you see. They think they've got so much insight into life and everything is so great, but they're just kidding themselves about it. Well, anyway, the whole point is that the presence of Christ in us is not a magic wand like some religious groups try to bring out, but nevertheless, His Spirit does affect our ability to make sound judgments about life. All right, now we're going to move on a little further, though. Because it pleased all the fullness to dwell in Him. That is, Christ is the expression of all the fullness of the universe. Now, let's make an analogy on that. That's not easy to understand either, but we can get at it, all right. Let's say here's a human person. The outward physical appearance is what we all see of that person, plus a few surface personality factors. But what we don't see or have the slightest concept of really is the intricacy of that brain and nervous system that is behind the person. All we see is the outward facade. But there's so much more behind that facade, that face. All right, now let's think in terms of Jesus Christ as being the face of God on the world. That's all we see, Jesus Christ. And we don't really see Him visually as we see each other, but we read about Him in the Bible and we can get an idea of who He is. We can talk about Him. There's a reference point in Christ. There isn't a very strong reference point in God if we did not have Christ to reveal God to us, because God is too much for us. He's too big. He's too far beyond the human mind to grasp. So all we know of God, we really know through Jesus Christ. But there is a lot more behind the person of Christ than what we are able to comprehend on the surface. So the fullness of the Godhead is expressed in Jesus Christ, but that gives us the capacity to touch Him for just a moment. That's all we can really understand, all we can comprehend. Our minds can only take in a little bit of God. But through Jesus Christ, we have the opportunity to get just that much of a touch of Him. And it's like the woman that had the issue of blood, probably a hemorrhaging problem. She had been for 18 years in this condition, and Jesus was passing along, and she touched Him. And she was immediately healed. And Jesus said, "Who touched me?" Because power had gone out of him. He sensed that somebody touched him. And the disciples were a little distressed because they said, "Look, everybody's thronging you here. What do you mean, who touched me?" And Jesus said, "Well, somebody touched me in a special way and some power went out. And I know that." Well, then the woman came and she told him of her situation. And He said, "Go your way, your faith has made you whole." But it was just that touch that was all that was needed. The power of God was there so much that just the touch is all that was needed. Now with you and me, we only touch just a brief moment of God, but that touch is enough to do what is needed in us. In Christ, all the fullness of the Godhead is resident, that is expressed. And we touch Christ spiritually. He comes to be within us. And that is all that we need. If we demanded always a physical or fleshly, that is to say, a human expression of Christ, we would beggar the situation. The fact that God can do things in us through His Spirit gives us more limitless opportunity of His help than if He's always got to be ringing our bell for us. And that's why we were talking last week. Some religions are bell-ringing societies. They're either ringing God's bell or trying to get Him to ring theirs. And something's always got to happen for them. They've got to have something outward. But the real power of God is the quiet thing. It's like, I gave the illustration a while ago, but I'll give it again. One day I was watching a sunset off of one of our beaches. It was a magnificent sunset, and there were these great cirrocumulus clouds moving across the sky quite rapidly. Great masses of clouds. Absolutely silently. I was out there where there wasn't much traffic or anything. And it was just silent and great power there. Then all of a sudden this little Piper Cub, this little private plane came roaring across the sky. It was breaking the silence. And chugging its way across there. And I thought of the difference between what God was doing and what man does. Man is so noisy about it, and he's got to have all of this action. And God moves things so quietly. It's like these giant redwoods, 100 feet tall, and here is the fluid being pumped 100 feet in the air, and those trees, not a sound. You put your ear right up on the bark and you're not going to hear much of anything. Of course, if we wanted to pump something 100 feet in the air, hear it from here to breakfast. All that God does is so quiet, but so powerful. And again, it's like the tide. Old Tennyson speaks of the tide that is too full for sound or foam. The tide that is too full for sound or foam. All that tremendous power there as versus a little brook that's babbling along in the meadow over the rocks and rills, you see? Now, what we're saying to you is that if you just relax, leave it to God to function in you the way He wants, He will move your life with tremendous power. But if you limit Him by always insisting that He's got to be noisy about it, and He's got to tell you things all the time, and make a big splash for you. You're going to make him, reduce him to the same idiocies that we get from man. And that's what it is. You're going to some meetings, there's a lot of babbling and noise and all kinds of things, and it really turned me off. I want to get out of there. So, here is the fullness of the Godhead resident in Christ. And we have a point of contact because Christ can talk to us in human terms. That is, we can understand Christ. We can understand God as such. But we know Jesus Christ. We can talk to him. He's got enough of the anthropomorphic qualities. That is, that he does have personality. We talked about that in another meeting that last night, in fact. God does not himself, that is, as the eternal spirit, we do not think in terms of personality with God. But he is a person, but we don't think in terms of modes of personality with a Godhead, because that's a human concept. Personality involves a brain and a nervous system and all kinds of things like this. Now, Jesus Christ has that. But that is the human expression of the Godhead. But God, the eternal spirit, while he is a being that we could say is a person, yet not in our strict personality terms. Jesus had personality. If you cut him, he bled. If you hurt him, he wept. You know, he had human personality. We understand that. We can relate to that. But then upon his resurrection, he became identified with the eternal origins that he had come from. And now we think of Jesus Christ in a little different terms than strictly humanistically, but still he had enough of the human on the earth that he understands our personality factors, the things that are a problem to us, the human relationships we have trouble with, and so forth. He understands. And we will always have trouble with human relationships. I want to keep impressing that point upon you. As I have said before, human relationships have been my specializations in training, in experience, counseling, interactions, and I would say that is an area of expertise, human relationships. But still, as a human being, I have my human difficulties too. You know, there are difficulties in relating to persons, and you say things that hurt somebody, misunderstand what somebody says, you try your best to be at peace with people and they misunderstand you, or you misunderstand them. And so I want to encourage people to believe that no matter how much of a specialist you may be in human relations, it is part of the human scene that we will struggle all of our lives with human relationships. So how do we treat that? We just be at peace about it and just say, well, that's the human element. We do our best to be right with people and do our best to treat them right and to understand them, to listen to them, and so forth. But in the last analysis, as long as we are human beings on the earth, we're going to struggle with these things. Well, now Jesus, having been a human being too, understands our struggle so that we can go to him and talk to him, and he knows what it is that we are confronting and what our problems are. He understands us. He may not listen to our belly aching too much. I mean, he may give us a little stronger way to handle life. He comforts us, but sometimes his comforting of us is giving us some instruction on how to grow up. But anyway, he is embroiled in the human scene because he spent years on the earth interacting with human beings and had his problems too, as you would find out if you read the Gospels. You find that Jesus had his problems in relating to people. They misunderstood him. I'm not sure I could say that Jesus misunderstood them. I don't think that he did, but they often misunderstood him. for example, one outstanding incident with Martha and Mary. Martha and Mary and Lazarus were special friends of Jesus. He had special friends. That's part of the human scene. Jesus did not float in the clouds across the tops of all the human beings. He was down on the earth, and he had special friendships. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were these special friends, but there was an incident in the home at Bethany where these three lived that suggests that Martha got a little upset with the situation with Jesus when he came to dinner one day, and Martha was out in the kitchen putting the lunch together, whatever they were eating, and Mary was in the front room. Wouldn't be called a living room in those days, but the front room. She was there at the feet of Jesus, listening to him. They were talking. So the Greek text is very vivid in some of these things, if you understand it. It's hard to translate it, but I can just give you the feeling here that according to the way this story is written in this original Greek text, which incidentally is what the New Testament was written in, original Greek language. Our English is a translation of the Greek text. It's more vivid there, and here's the picture. Here's Martha out in the kitchen, and she's busy getting things ready. Here is Mary sitting at the feet of Jesus, and they're talking, you see. And Martha's getting hotter by the minute. And she's banging stuff around. And all of a sudden, and this is the way it reads, actually, you get this flavor. All of a sudden, she whirls around, and she says, Lord, she says, tell Mary to get in here and help me. And he said, don't you care that Mary isn't helping me? And so Jesus said to Martha, 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 you're anxious and troubled about many things, but Mary hath chosen that good part, and it will not be taken from her. You see, that was a little human interaction that was a problematical thing. Now, Jesus was right about it all, but it didn't keep Martha from seething underneath at the way things were going. It's a very human situation. We run into those situations in the Gospels quite a bit. Now, I just want to really make it clear to you that all the power of the Godhead, of the universe, is behind Jesus Christ. He's the facade, the front of that. But in his interaction with humanity on the earth, he acquired those special sensitivities to the human factor that allows him now to be open and sensitive to us and our problems. The hardest thing for a Christian to do is to relax in the presence of these struggles, because people have learned from, unfortunately, they've been taught by inadequate teachers, of which the church is replete, that they've got to get that inner brain of theirs and their natural person perfectly coordinated with their spiritual person. It's never going to be that way. In other words, they think if they've dropped the ball on some human relationship, it must be they're not very spiritual or they're not very Christian. People often say that, well, now you're not much of a Christian if you do that. Well, that has nothing to do with being a Christian. Theoretically, you hope that the things that you learn and the way you live with the Lord is going to make you a better person to live with, and it really should. But as far as the actions are concerned, it's well to remember that you're a Christian if you have Christ with you, just as much as you're a Jones if you're born into the Jones family. No matter how you act, you're still a Jones. And to say to somebody, that's not very Jones-like, you know, that may be true, but then to call and question whether they are a Jones or not because of the way they act, that's something else. So people have to understand that the Spirit of Christ is at work in their hearts, all right, and he's helping them, but it takes time to build a character, and it takes time to get rid of a lot of the notions we have and the habits we have, and we're likely to offend people and be out of order with them, and We mustn't think that that means Christ is not with us or that we're dropping the ball or anything. It's just one of those areas we've got to shape up. The Lord always wants us to act properly toward others, and it doesn't excuse us, but it does help us to be maybe more at peace and give ourselves a chance to grow. I've used the analogy of the house, building a house, I think is a very good analogy. Let's say that you're building a new home and you've got the blueprint there and you've gotten a contractor and he starts to put the house together. So you're going to bring your friend up to see the house. They're partway through the building process. And you bring your friend over to see the house, and all that is there, the studs, the roof is on, the yard's all full of cement and boards and everything else. And it doesn't look very attractive at that point. And you come proudly up to the saying, "See our new house." And your friend takes a look at it, and they say, "Oh, that's a terrible place. That looks awful. I can't understand why you would build such a terrible thing." And you say, "Well, wait a minute, it's not finished yet." "All you see are the studs. Wait till he gets it finished. We'll come back in a few months, and then you'll see." Now, see, Christ has that same situation with us. He's building us. We're in the process. But people look at our lives, and they say, "Well, you're not very much," and that's true. Right now, we're not very much. We're struggling, failing, foolish human beings. If you learn anything when you get to be my age, you learn that you're a child and that you're ignorant and that you're a fool. You learn that by now. If you haven't learned that yet, then you got a few more years to grow up. But you know that all human beings are in that same category, and knowledge is only relative. The more you know, the more you know you don't know. See, it's all relative, and the more wise you think you are, the more a fool you are. Not wise. We're not wise. We're fools. But the Lord puts up with us, and we do the best we can. And we struggle through our lives. So here's all the power of the Godhead behind us. The Spirit of Christ is in us. But we have to then be just open to let Him work it out in our lives, which He is doing. And you should grow up. The Lord will help you to mature. You learn more and more how to cope with yourself. You never trust yourself, you see. The flesh, according to the Scripture, is innately a problem, and you never trust it. You have to say to yourself, "Well, given the circumstances, I can fail just as easily now as I did before I became a Christian." But knowing that is your safeguard, because now you say, "Well, okay, I'll watch it. I have to be careful because I know that I'm a human being and I might make a mistake." I think I can tell this all right with impunity. My son attended UC San Diego years ago, quite a few years now. But anyway, I remember when he first, I think it was the night before he was going to go head for school here. I was a little uneasy with him because he'd been very cocky about things, and I thought he might be a little overconfident about his ability to cope with life and get himself into trouble. So I was a little uneasy about it. So I took him out to dinner the night before he left, and we just sat there and had a nice conversation. I didn't bring that up. I just quietly looked at the situation. And then he said to me while we were sitting there, "You know," he says, "I realized one thing, that I'm really going to have to depend on Christ to help me, because I know that I'm not strong enough in the flesh to cope with these things." Well, then my heart was at peace. I was completely at ease about sending him down there. Once I knew he knew the threat, the peril about it all, then he's all right, because then he'll watch it. So that's the way it is with us. And going back again to the Pharisees, Jesus told them that because they thought they saw, they were really blind, and that he couldn't help them because they thought they saw too much. Now in verse 20, "And through him," let's see, 19, "because in him it pleased all the fullness to dwell, and through him to reconcile all things unto himself." That word reconcile is what we have to finish with tonight. Because to reconcile is a sesquipedalian word. The Greek word there means to change back again or to restore or to recover. We know the word conciliate or conciliatory, I think, because we read it every once in a while. It comes up in the news of a board of conciliation. But to be conciliatory toward someone is to be brought to peace with them. To reconcile is to bring back again to peace. To reconcile us to God means to change us back again into a position of favor with God. That's what it simply means. To restore us to favor with God. To reconcile. Now the world is in a mess. You may have observed that by now. We're in a situation where Satan has occupied not only the world, but the heart of man in a measure. Talking about little immoralities here. Now I'm talking about the great thrust of selfishness and pride and so forth that keeps the world constantly in turmoil. The avarice, the greed, and so on. These are all the trademark of man today since Satan's occupation of this world. Now we must understand that we live under conditions of occupation. That's what the whole history of the Bible is. The whole of the Bible is about the process of God's reconciling, bringing us back again to the position that we had before the fall. So we're in occupied condition. I have this in the next section of the commentary is coming out. That is, we're dealing with this very subject of the conflict of the world that we're living in. And I used the illustration of the occupation of France during World War II. The German forces occupied Paris and governed France from that during the war. Now the whole history of France during that period of time was a history of conflict. Distortion. The customs, the culture of France would not have been clearly seen during those years. So if one were to pick up a book on France and it were to cover the war years, they might get a distorted view of what France was really like. All right, now you have to look at the Bible that way as a history of the years during which the world is occupied by Satan. And mankind is in a distorted situation. And he has the same problems that a Frenchman would have during the German occupation. The governing body there was hostile to him. And life was a hostile thing. It was austere and it was difficult. The only way people could really live in ease would be to collaborate with the forces of the enemy, you see. Now today we're living in a world that Satan has distorted because he occupies it. Therefore we're more part of the resistance movement than we are the others. You see, we're in that situation where the occupation forces of Satan are here and we're in conflict. So the point about it all is that if we are in continual conflict with our lives, there is a reason. The reason we're in conflict is that we're in hostile territory. So we should not feel that God has abandoned us if life is tough, but rather just take it as part of the game and be part of the resistance movement rather than part of the collaborators.
Not make all the noise
longer. No, don't make any noise. Just go quietly on your way and trust the Lord to work it out, because He will.